they were like, okay, well, he's not going to make it till the age of 10. And then when 10 came, they were like, he's probably not going to make 13. And, you know, eventually you stop listening to what doctors say because clearly I'm still here. So, yeah.
Hi, I'm Brooke Milhouse. Welcome to Disabled and Proud, the podcast that does exactly what it says on the tin. Each week, the show highlights an awesome disabled guest speaking about their own disability, why they're proud to be disabled, and why they're proud to be themselves.
Louis, welcome to Disabled and Proud. How are you today?
I'm really well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's really great to have you on. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. And I feel like I'm going to learn something new and something different, which is what I like. So,
good. I hope so.
Yeah, me too. The first question that I ask absolutely everybody who comes on this podcast is, how do you refer to your disability?
Wow, that is a very important question. I guess usually I would use an SMA or spinal muscular atrophy. And then I would go into an explanation usually because most people don't know what that is. So it's essentially a degenerative muscular weakening condition. So the older I get, the worse that degeneration becomes.
Okay. And is that something from birth, or is that as you get older, it gets more progressive and more prominent, or is it like available to see at birth? That sounds really silly, but you kind of get what I'm saying.
Yeah, so it's different from person to person, but onset for me was 8 months after birth. My parents started realizing that I wasn't hitting the usual milestones that a baby should. And coming from South Africa, very different to the rest of the world in terms of knowledge. So we ended up having to see 15 different doctors before someone actually said, maybe we should do a test. A group of five neurologists who specialized in neurology in South Africa did a muscle biopsy and determined that I had SMA just before my third birthday. It wasn't really a proper diagnosis. If we think of the standards today and the fact that SMA has different types, they just gave me a blanket diagnosis. And I guess that kind of paved the way for the rest of my life because that's what we were told, right?
Yeah. I can't believe it took 15 different doctors to actually say we need to do something about this. Like, obviously in the UK, there we have systematic problems with and systemic problems with the NHS, and diagnosis times are long and you get passed from pillar to post, but 15 different doctors. And was that like a case of your parents knocking on doors, or was it almost like one doctor doesn't know, so they pass you on to the next one?
It was more my parents going from door to door because they didn't really believe what was being said. So, you know, some people said, oh, don't worry, he's just developing really slowly. Or other doctors were like, well, actually, we don't really know. It could be this or it could be that. And it was really, I guess, traumatic for my parents because even post-diagnosis, they told my mum and dad that I wouldn't be around to see my next birthday. And then when that came, they were like, okay, well, he's not going to make it till the age of 10. And then when 10 came, they were like, he's probably not going to make 13. And, you know, eventually you stop listening to what doctors say because clearly I'm still here. So, yeah.
That is genuinely wild. Like, just to let you know, he's not going to make the next birthday, maybe the next birthday. Yeah. Oh, it might be the next one. Oh, it might not be the next one. And like, here we are years and years down the line.
Yeah.
And that must have been so difficult for your parents because, like you said, you were given like a blanket diagnosis. But as we know, there are multiple different types of SMA, or is it like categorized? How does it work?
Yeah, so there's the typical types are type 1, 2, and 3, but we also have type 0, which is a little bit more niche. But the typical types are type 1, 2, and 3, and I only found out 2 years ago that I was type 2 because I'm now on treatment that's available via the NHS, and it's one of the main reasons why we relocated here from South Africa. So I guess it also really kind of gave the wrong mindset to my parents, because my mum was like, well, he doesn't need physiotherapy because, you know, it's not, the doctors have said we never need it. But you come to the UK and they're like, you should have been having physiotherapy every day since you were born, right? So it's different standards and different knowledge. I mean, we have to remember that I was born in 1985, and there was very little knowledge around SMA, especially in South Africa. So I guess doctors were, in inverted commas, doing the best that they could. But I think that the approach was really, I guess, misguiding, because they just gave people the wrong mindset from the beginning. And it obviously had long-term consequences, I guess.
Yeah. And that is, it's a really important point, isn't it? That, like, there are different standards of care all across the world, and like what works in one country won't necessarily work in another, and knowledge is not necessarily in one country and it might be in another. And I think that is also really a really key point, is that because you were where you were, you got the treatment that you had. Had you been elsewhere, you would have got other, like, different treatment. And actually, really interestingly, so I was born in Australia, but my parents relocated to England, which is why I sound like I have a really strong British accent, because when I was born, they, like, Australia was not hot on prosthetics. Amazing if it was if I'd been born with like a cardiovascular problem, they were number one in the world, but prosthetics was not their thing. And it just happened to be that the UK was where prosthetics was taking off. And that's why my parents moved here when I was so little. So I can really understand that whole idea of relocating for like all, like for better healthcare, because like my parents did it for me. And actually, interestingly, I'd love to talk about your childhood, especially in South Africa. Like, how was that experience for you being a disabled child in South Africa? What was that like?
Well, I mean, there's many layers to this story. So my mum and my dad got divorced when I was 5 years old, and that they had already had issues prior to that when they had separated. So essentially my mum was a single mum, and I have a sister who, there's nothing, she's completely fine, there's nothing wrong with her, and trying to balance a child that had really complex needs with a child who still needs to go to school and do extracurricular activities, a decision was made that it would be better for me to go to a boarding school. And I went to a boarding school really young, and I had to really just find my place, because most of the people there spoke Afrikaans, and I had never heard Afrikaans in my life before. I got there, and it was really strange, because I remember the first couple of months going there every Sunday when my mum would drop me off. It would be really emotional, and I would be crying because I don't want to be left alone. And you know, there were bullies as well that I had to put up with in boarding school, and it was really weird, because there are moments in boarding school that I really loved. You know, that camaraderie and the friendships that you build were phenomenal, and I think a lot of those experiences made me the resilient person I am today. It was really hard. So I was in boarding school for 10 years before my mum was really in a position to take me out and be a day scholar, or someone who goes to school and back home every day. And hospital appointments were rife in the first years of my life, because this is something like really cutting edge in those days. So they kind of used me as a guinea pig, and you're sitting in a room with 17, 18 students and a couple of doctors, and they're now talking and asking questions. And I mean, for me, that was normal, right? Because it started from when I was younger. But if you think about it now, that's not normal for a child to experience.
Yeah, and I really appreciate what you said, like, it's not normal for a child to experience. And it's like having 16, 17 students, like medical students, just watching you. like as you said, like you're the guinea pig. That isn't normal.
No.
And not very many people have that experience either. So it's really interesting to hear about it from the flip side, because obviously when we think about medical students, they're there to learn, right? And they're there to understand their profession, and that's why they go through so much rigorous training. But actually to be on the flip side and be like, actually, it's a really weird experience to have 17 or 18 different people who you don't know, almost like poke and prod you in like the most intimate parts of your body, and also like the most intimate parts of yourself. Because when we talk about disability, the two are very, very interlinked. It's not necessarily like the best experience in the world. It's really effing weird.
Yeah, it is. And I think probably I'm grateful that it started really young, so that it became normal, so that it was easier to cope with. I wouldn't want a worst enemy to go through some of the tests that I had to go through, you know, where you're being poked and prodded. I remember once they took blood from my groin, and that's probably the worst pain I've ever experienced in my life. So, you know, and those are really, I guess, those extra add-ons that you get with a disability, right? Sometimes you just have to do what you have to do. And I think there came a point in my life just before my 10th birthday where I had a 90-degree scoliosis to the left. So my spine was literally folding in half, and I was crushing all my organs, and I was really ill. I was getting sick all the time. And doctors said, look, the only way we're going to fix this is if we fuse your spine. And my mum was like, no, it's dangerous. We can't do that. You know, there's got to be something else you can do. So we went down the whole brace route, and the brace wasn't doing anything. So eventually I just said to my mum, you know what, I've got to do it, because this is not fun for me anymore, right? So had spinal surgery. It was 8.5 hours in theater, and they basically made my back straight for me again. And I think that's where life actually started for me, because I was able to sustain my health and not be having to go to the hospital all the time, and having to have breaks during school because I wasn't coping, and I actually picked up a lot of weight because I was eating properly. It was really weird, because you think that life's okay, and then they fix my back, and all of a sudden there's all these possibilities for me, and I had more stamina, and I could do more things. And so that was a really positive decision that we made when I was younger, and I think that kind of set me up to like just do the best I can at school. Unfortunately, in my teens, there was a decision made by a stepfather that I guess decided it would be best for me to not be in school and be at home, and that also really stagnated my growth, right? Because I didn't finish school, and it made it really hard to get going to the work environment. But again, I guess as we disabled people do, we adapt and we make the best of it, right?
Yeah, and actually that ties in so nicely, because I was going to ask, how has your disability impacted the career choices that you've made in terms of like what you then went on to study and then what you do now as a job? How, when we think about our careers when we're like younger and coming out of that school age, how is your disability, or maybe it didn't, but how did that impact your career choices and progress your career?
Well, I think in South Africa, it definitely impacted my decisions, because if we compare South Africa to the UK, for example, I would say South Africa is at least 10 years behind in terms of infrastructure, in terms of the way they support people with disabilities. It's really a minefield of challenges. So most of the time, my career choices were whoever was willing to give me a job, no matter what that job was. So the beginning of my career was really doing everything and anything. And my first job was in recruitment. I knew nothing about it, and basically said, here's a list of people you can call. This is what we can offer them. Let's see what you can do. And that job really came from a chance encounter with my partner at the time and her boss, and the fact that my partner is not really a people's person, and she was better at being creative. So they basically gave me her job because they saw I'm really good with people and I can build rapport quickly with people. So that's a really good skill to have in the recruitment industry. And it took me about 6 months to find my feet and started making a name for myself and building a good reputation and doing the job really well. I then got headhunted within the same industry to be a recruitment manager. And that's kind of where things kind of fell apart. So the relationship ended up coming to an end, and the owner of the business made enough money from the business and decided that she wants to shut down the business and no longer operate anymore. So I was kind of stuck with no relationship, no job. What do I do? You know, and after leaving home at the age of 22, and I'm now 25 years old, and thinking, well, holy heck, where do I go now? Right. Yeah. So I ended up having to go home, and that's kind of where the challenges really started, because most corporate businesses don't give you an interview unless you have the qualifications and the experience. So I would be going for interviews and basically being told, well, sorry, we don't think that you have the qualifications to suit your experience, or we would drive an hour to an interview and find that there are stairs to get into the building, even though on the first page of my CV it says I'm a wheelchair user. So there are a lot of challenges, and I guess for the 15 years of my career in South Africa, seven to 8 years of that time was really spent being unemployed, and having to move back to Mumba, then move out again, and then move to Mumba, then move out again. So that was really challenging. And it created a lot of family tensions and things like that, because they can only help so much, right? Because they also only have a certain amount of money, and I was feeling guilty because I couldn't contribute. So it was just really challenging for us to just settle, if that makes sense. And I then met my current partner and moved in with her and got some opportunities to go and do telesales, and again proved my worth and moved my way up to manager, and they moved offices, and basically it was just too far away for a household with one car and children and things like that. So I had to quit that job because, well, essentially they fired me, but it was kind of like a mutual parting because they were moving offices too far away. And that's kind of where my employment stopped in South Africa. And I think this is why I like to tell the story, is when we came to the UK, there were a lot of factors involved, like treatment available for my condition, but also the ability to build a new life, right? The opportunities in abundance. And since coming here, I've done so much more for my career in the 3 years living in the UK. It, with all the years that I worked in South Africa combined, I've still done more here in the UK. It's been phenomenal for me.
Yeah, and I completely understand that, like, moving somewhere different because you want that, like, new start. Also, like, again, from, like, a healthcare perspective, what can be done for me in this country? Because I get it. Like, I've had the same thing, except I wasn't necessarily part of it. I was too young, but I can completely understand it and that thought process. And actually, what was it like transitioning from South Africa to the UK in terms of, like, the healthcare system? Was it easy? Was it hard? How was that experience?
I mean, for me, the UK has really been a playground, right? I feel like a kid in a candy shop because this is stuff that's never been available to me in my life.
So
work opportunities, accessible places and accessible infrastructure. You know, like in South Africa, there is no public transport system that caters to disabled people, right? So you're having to adapt or rent really expensive private transport if you want to go places. So transitioning in the UK for me has been a joy because of what's available and what's out there. And I mean, let's not sugarcoat it, because there's still a lot that needs to be done in the UK in the disability space. But for me, contrasting SA to here, it's like chalk and cheese, because I think for me, the only negative part of, if we talk about the medical system, is the waiting times. So I had to wait 8 months for, almost 9 months for my official type 2 diagnosis, mm-hmm. which is a genetics test, because of the backlog. And sometimes you're waiting 3 or 4 months to see a specialist. But I would rather wait to see someone and get the quality of care and the standard of medical professionals here than go back to South Africa. You know, we were having to pay approximately £350 a month for private medical insurance in South Africa. And my mum,
that is a lot.
It's a lot. And when my mum started me on private medical insurance, it was a lot lower, but we had to pay for 2 years before I was eligible to actually use the benefits of the medical insurance because I have a pre-existing condition. So that's the difference. You know, in South Africa, the government medical infrastructure has some of the best doctors in the world, but it's the aftercare that's the challenge. It's the hospital standards and the nursing standards that are far below what they should be. You know, when you're trying to have your dinner on your bed and there's cockroaches on your bed trying to get at your food, and that's what it was like. So you know, lying in bed and needing to have a wee, and you're calling and they can hear you, but they just don't get up from the nursing station to come and help you. They'll come and help you when they're ready to help you. Those are the differences between there and here. And I think that the NHS gets a lot of flack, but there is a lot of positive things that the NHS does for the UK, and I'm really grateful that we have a system like that in place here.
Yeah. I know my face is like contorting and dropping when you're telling me these things, but it's because I've only ever known the NHS. I think that everywhere has the same healthcare system. And I'm aware that that's not the case. Like, I've done my traveling, I've been around different places and I've experienced it. But I think when I hear it again, and particularly, I think there's something about hearing about other people's healthcare who are also disabled, and when they don't get the same level of care that I've necessarily got my whole life, which I'm aware is an incredible privilege. Like, it's an incredible privilege that I've been under the NHS for my entire life. Mm-hmm. I think it's just so shocking, because you expect to have the exact same, and it's not like that at all. And it is quite wild that you had to wait for that diagnosis of like category 2, and that should have been something that you'd known like from the onset, and you didn't. And there's so much to be said in that. And actually, like, a move to the UK for you is the best thing in the entire world, because in terms of like healthcare, because you've now got, it's all written down. There are notes, there are people on your side, there are specialists. Because if anybody doesn't know that when you deal with the NHS, you need a paper trail for absolutely every single effing thing. Like, you have to have such a paper trail to be able to be like, this is what I said here, and this is what I said here, and this doctor said this, and this person said this, and for you to be able to have that is kind of invaluable. And it honestly blows my mind that people give the NHS a lot of stick. Don't get me wrong, there are a lot of systemic problems with it. There really, really are. However, what it does for so many people is invaluable. And we are so, so lucky to have that system. Yes, it's flawed, but we are so lucky that it exists. Because the flip side is we don't have that, and I don't really understand how medical insurance works, because I haven't had to experience it. So the idea that we might at some point in time have to pay for medical insurance kind of scares like the living crap out of me, because I don't get how it works, and I'm so used to having like my doctor in my village and it being taken care of there and then.
Yeah, I think that if that ever happens, and let's hope it doesn't, but I think if that ever happens, I think the medical landscape is going to change a lot in the UK. First of all, I think that there are too many people who are not going to be able to afford to go on a system like that, and it's going to make the cost of living crisis even bigger. And we have to remember that these type of insurance bodies or businesses are there to make money. And people with pre-existing conditions are a major risk for that money, right? So if you think, like, in South Africa, I had to have surgery in my late 20s, and the doctors decided to keep me in the ICU for the whole stay because they knew that at least in the ICU I would get a proper taking care of, essentially. And that cost my private medical insurance over 200 grand. So what would that be in pounds? That would be like, let's call it 1,800 pounds, right? So it doesn't sound like a lot, but 1,800 pounds is what my private medical insurance had to pay. And if you think that I'm paying, let's say, 350 pounds a month, that's 5 months worth of premiums, and yeah, they've got their money back, right? It's really challenging. So, but I don't think that that's a system that's going to work in this country. I don't think people can afford it in this country. And I also think that we will probably see bedlam in the streets with people protesting that decision ever gets made. Because I think when that privilege gets taken away and they actually realize what they're getting, people will have something to say.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Interestingly, I wonder if you have a piece of advice for a younger version of yourself that hasn't been through a big move, that doesn't necessarily have a diagnosis, that is at boarding school and they don't necessarily love it. Is there a piece of advice that you would give younger version of you?
Well, I would say don't give up, because I think, you know, it's when people see me today, they see someone who's very resilient and is doing so much and making a difference. But the truth of the matter is that wasn't how I was all my life. There were many times that I gave up along the way and had to wait until I bumped my head really hard before I realized that actually I can make a difference to my current situation. I can change this. So my advice would be is just don't give up. If you know what's right, if you know what something's not what it should be, or you know that there's something wrong and you keep being told that there isn't, it's just don't stop asking the questions. Even if you have to go to 15 doctors, like I had to, what should I say, like my parents had to, it's really important to accept what we are, right? So I think for me, the biggest change in my mindset was when I acknowledged that I had a disability and that I was, and I chose that that's not going to get in the way, because otherwise it gets in the way so much. You know, you kind of make excuses for yourself. Well, I have a disability, so I don't have to do that. Or, you know, I have a disability, so it's not that important. But actually, it's very important to live a life. You know, I say, if I look at the landscape in the UK, I say that people are given a much better start in life than what we have in South Africa. You know, I went to a special school. I didn't go to a mainstream school where I had a chance to integrate with the inverted commas normal world, you know. And that was really hard for me when I transitioned from being out of school at home all my life to in the big bad world and trying to understand how people work, because I've never been around it. You know, the only exposure I had to, again in quotes, normal people were the nurses or the people taking care of us at school, or my mum and my sister. That was pretty much it, right? And that's a very small part of the picture in the real world. So I think the advice is just don't let that get in the way, and don't give up. You know, if you know what you know, do it.
Yeah. There's something that you touched on there, and I was wondering if we could delve a bit deeper into that. And you said it wasn't until I had a bump on the head and I had to realise that I had to change my situation and accept where I was. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit more about that, because there's a lot to be said about mindset. And now there's a lot to be said about toxic positivity, but there's also a lot to be said about being able to change your mindset and looking at things from a different perspective. And I was wondering if we could chat about that bump on the head that you had, or like that realisation moment.
Well, there were many, so it depends which one you want to talk about. So I think there came a point in my life when I got really comfortable with just being at home. And this was when I left school and stayed at home every day. And you kind of, when you're leaving school and you're actually, the decision's been made, you're not going back, you're kind of excited, like, oh yeah, I'm going to be able to be at home, play PlayStation, I'm going to just, you know, relax and do nothing. And then that gets stale so quickly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't have exposure to people, you don't have exposure to your friendship network anymore. You know, I only had a mobile phone when I was 16, right? Yeah. So there was no connectivity to the world in the way that we have today. And it was really coming to that realization that, am I really going to live at home for the rest of my life? Like, is this really what I want?
Yeah.
And you know, hearing people say, you know, you've got so much potential, why don't you do this or why don't you do that? And you kind of shrug it off, and you're 22 years old and you realize, well, crap, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
If something happens to my mom tomorrow, what am I doing? Like, where do I go?
Mm-hmm.
Is my sister going to take care of me? Is another family member going to take care of me? But then I'm just back into square one again where I'm living with someone. So that was probably the turning point of that mindset of I need to do better than this. You know, I can do better than this. And moved out, and I didn't even have a job. I just moved in with my partner at the time and became an instant dad because she had 4 children. And I was like, this is it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to show the world that I'm not defined by HA, or
uh-huh.
I'm not going to be defined by SMA. And it worked for 3 years. And then, as I said earlier, got stuck between a rock and a hard place, had to come back home, applied for jobs as much as I could. It never really helped because I got like a part-time job in a couple of months and then unemployed again. It was really hard. And when I moved in with my current partner and I finally got a job, I said that I'm not going to give up the job really easily, and circumstances took that away from me. And you then get back into that rut of, okay, well, I'll be at home, you know, I'll be a stay-at-home dad, and I'll make sure that the house is clean and
mm-hmm.
cook with my PA, you know, make sure that food's ready when everyone comes home. And not that there's anything wrong with that, right? They are stay-at-home dads all the time. But that's, I wanted more for myself than that.
Yeah.
And it meant that I had to make necessary moves and decisions around that. And I think all that hard work and all that bumping my head and making tough decisions really is starting to pay off now that I live in the UK. I do many things and more than most people because I feel like I'm at a deficit. I'm kind of behind my peers because I don't have a big pension and I don't have the long-standing career that most people have at my age. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I kind of felt like I was behind. So I've just been doing anything and everything I can to slowly but surely build myself up. And it's been a bit of a bumpy road, but as I said, it's starting to pay off.
Yeah. Something that's just popped into my mind is obviously you grew up in South Africa, then you moved to England, and that means that you've had experiences in both places and how they view disability. And I was wondering, are there key differences in how South Africa views disability to how England views disability, or is it very much the same?
Well, in the societal way, I think it's very much the same, where there are those assumptions made, those societal assumptions of, oh, well, he's in a wheelchair, so he can't speak, so let's speak to the person with them instead.
Yeah.
I mean, that still happens in the UK, right? I think in terms of the workplace, there's a major contrast because the UK is so progressive. Disability has a place on the stage with other protected characteristics in the UK. Whereas in South Africa, it's still very much seen as advantageous labour. So they offer a lot of work internships to people with disabilities because it's cheap labor. And then at the end of their term, they say, sorry, we're not going to renew your contract. And
wow.
So you get paid very little money to do the average person's job because you're an intern. And then at the end of the year, they just find someone else to replace you.
Yeah.
Right? There's a lot of social conditioning that still gets in the way in South Africa in the workplace. I remember when I got a job in telesales, the boss apologized because he said that when he first saw me, he thought that I was not going to amount to anything because of the extent of my disability. He was like, when I saw you, I was like, this guy's proper effed up. Like, how's he going to cope in this environment? This is the things he's saying to himself, right? And after I had proved myself, he said, look, I have to apologize. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. This was my assumption, and you've proved me wrong, right? So
yeah.
I think that still happens today everywhere in the world, but I think that it happens a lot less in the UK.
Mm-hmm. I totally understand that, like, talking to yourself when you see someone who's disabled and you're like, oh my God, I don't know how they're going to react in this situation, because we've all experienced that, and it's almost mm-hmm. like part and parcel of what we have to do on a daily basis is almost like prove people wrong. But mm-hmm. it still shocks me when I hear it, because I'm like, why would you think that? Because I don't think that about myself. And I think that's the thing with the disabled people and like the disabled community in general, is that actually we really back ourselves a lot more than like average Joe blogs, because we have to, like, we have to mm-hmm. be our own backing it. And if we don't back ourselves, nobody else is going to back us. And like, you completely just proven that point.
Yeah, it's true. I completely agree with that. I think that there are exceptions to that rule, though, right? Mm-hmm. There are people who advocate for us and want to be really good allies for us, and that's great. But I think there is still that self-realization for a lot of people with disabilities that we need to do a lot of this ourselves,
yeah.
right? And I think, and this is something I've said before to people, is that I think that in the whole world, not just in the UK, in the whole world, there are too many people with disabilities who are sitting back in the hope that advocates or campaigners or activists like the Loud and Proud Disabled people that we see out there doing amazing things to make a difference, and not realizing that change is coming so slowly because they're relying on those people to make the difference. If we don't all stand up together and support one another and push one another, you know, you don't have to be Loud and Proud to be an advocate. You know, just sharing someone's post, you're shouting Loud and Proud is advocating. You know, it's those little nuances that people forget about that allow us to make such a difference in this world. And the sooner we stand together as a majority, the quicker change will happen.
Yeah, there is a lot to be said for nuance and disability, and it's something that actually a lot of people forget, is that
mm-hmm.
there is so much nuance and disability. Everybody is completely individual, and it doesn't matter mm-hmm. if your diagnosis or you have the same condition. It could be the exact same on a piece of paper, but how you relate to it, how mm-hmm. it affects you, how you think about it, how you feel about it is going to be so individual to that person yep. that actually the idea that one size fits all just will never ever work with disability. And like, to be fair, it doesn't really work in any other part of life either, but particularly in disability, you can't pigeonhole it at all, because as soon as you pigeonhole it, it's out of date. That it, you know, if you printed a handbook that you gave to every disabled person upon birth or upon acquiring their disability, as soon as it's printed on the paper, it's out of date already. Like, it's done.
Agreed. It's like technology, right? It moves too quickly. I think this is why I love my role at Milden as a diversity mm-hmm. and inclusion consultant, because it really puts me in a position to help change that perception and rather get people to focus on equitable experiences rather than equal experiences, because
mm-hmm.
equal experiences is that pigeonhole blanket approach that never works.
Yeah.
Never works. There will always be someone excluded if you think of things in an equality standpoint. And I think when we look at society and some of the questions we still get asked as disabled people, you realize that there's still so much work to do.
Yeah. So it's so true. And actually, I love to talk about being a DEI consultant, because that's essentially what you do, right? And I'd love it if you could just divulge just like a little bit of information, like what is the difference between equality and equity, and what type of things do you discuss and facilitate for people?
Sure. So I think there's a great illustration that I can obviously not put on the screen right now, so I'm going to try explain it. But if you can imagine a fence and a football match going on behind that fence, And in front of the fence, you have three individuals who are all different. So one is really tall and can see over the fence. One is shorter and can just see over the fence if there's a box underneath their feet. And then there's a wheelchair user with a box that can't see over the fence at all because they can't get on the box, right? And then if you give a box to the tall person as well, so everyone has one box each, which is equality, the tall person has even more of an advantage to see the game than the other two. But if we take that box away from the tall person, because they can then still see over the fence, give the box to the shorter person so that they have two boxes, that's now again an advantage for the short person because they can now proper see the match. And if we build a ramp for the wheelchair user to go up onto a platform in order for them to see over that fence, that's what we call equity.
Yeah.
So it's about giving people what they need and not saying, well, we're giving everyone this because that's what we're supposed to do. It doesn't work that way. Same as in the workplace. So I said this before we started recording. I use Dragon Naturally Speaking on my laptop to type, open and close applications and do a lot of work on my laptop. And if I go into a job and they give me a laptop, that's great, but I'm not going to be able to use it without the software, right? So I know everyone gets a laptop, but not everyone's going to be as stuck as I am without my software. So those are the differences that I think get missed when we focus on equality rather than equity.
Yeah. I know the exact image that you're talking about. And when you started explaining it, I was like, I really hope it's the one with the fence. I think it's such a great way to explain equity because it's not that everybody deserves one box. It's that you need it tailored to you regardless of what your needs are. Yeah. And actually, that's more important than if everybody gets the same, because if everybody gets the same, it, like you said, it's a blanket approach. It doesn't really work. And when we think about blanket approach to disability, it doesn't really work because how I interact with the world and how you interact with the world are two very different things. But actually, we're both still disabled. The way that the world disables me is very different to how it's going to disable you. And that's a really important key takeaway, is that, again, not every disability is the same. We're all very different. But actually, how society then interacts with us is also completely different as well.
Yep.
And that's the essence, I think, of equity, is that everybody's different, so everybody needs different things. This idea that we all deserve one thing or we all get one thing doesn't work. And it's a point proven again and again and again, and I don't need to repeat myself, but I love that image so much.
Yeah, it's a really good way to help people who don't get it, right? It's as clear as day, and it's very basic, actually. It's just a flat drawing. It's not anything special, like a whole presentation to try train someone to understand. That visual alone is a really great example, and I guess that's why I used it. And I think, you know, the work that I do with Milden and the work that I do with SMA UK, which is the charity that looks after my condition here in the UK, you know, it's realizing those differences with people and how do we support them as best as we can. You know, if we look at our very dear friend Kelly Gordon, right, she has the same disability that I do, but you know from meeting the both of us, I'm a lot more affected than she is. Kelly can still move her arms and do things herself. I can't do that anymore, right? So so it's about the world needing to realize that. And I guess, you know, you were talking about mindset, and I think that's also why I started Unstoppable Living, because long-term, I really want to be in a position to help other disabled people who are stuck like I was, to help them realize their value and the worth that they can contribute to society. They don't have to be a CEO to do that. You know, they can start their own businesses. They can do work that they're able to do. It's not about being rich and successful that defines who they are as a person. It's the fact that they're coming to that realization where, hold on a minute, I can do that. Or, yeah, I've been looking at my disability in totally the wrong light. You know, it's those subtle things that I want to help people with. And you know, I'm currently mentoring a young lady who has the same condition that I do, and I don't really want to use her name But in the 5 sessions we've had together, she has grown exponentially. Just helping her realize her abilities and the way that she addresses herself and the language she uses for herself was really holding her back. You know, I want to make sure that the generation behind me don't have to go through the same crap that I had to go through. And that's why I do all 3 of those jobs, because it's really about paving a way for future generations, because the systemic exclusion, if for the lack of a better word, has actually been going on for far too long.
And what you just said holds like a really dear place in my heart, is that the younger generation shouldn't have to go through what we've been through in terms of like medical professionals being medically gaslit, society's expectations of us, how society treats us, the scholastic system. There's so much that is encompassed in that, and I think that's a really beautiful thing to want to give someone else, and like particularly the younger generation. And to be honest, like it's why I started this podcast. I always think about, what if there was a younger version of me who could hear these conversations between disabled people, where they weren't, oh my goodness, you're a Paralympian, therefore you are this quote unquote brilliant disabled person, and your whole entire worth is put on that because you are a good disabled person by societal standards. But equally, like, oh, the flip side is you're a down and out, and you're a benefits grounder, and you amount to nothing, and you're forever taking off the state, and you're worthless in this society. Where were the conversations between the disabled people who were just actually smashing life, and they were actually happy and proud of being disabled? And I love that. So I really applaud that mission, because I feel like it's a mission that we're both on together, just taking different forms. And I think that's a really beautiful thing to want to give.
Yeah, I think you also have to realize is that I'm 38 years old, and I'm learning things from your podcast. So it's not just the youth that can learn, right? I think that the reason why I do what I do is I just want to make sure that everyone just has the best start in life, or at least the best opportunity in life to do what they want to do. I think sometimes we do get pigeonholed by whether it's our families, or whether it's our friends, or whether it's our society. They shouldn't be dictating what we can and can't do with our lives, right? And you know, when we go back to the 60s and 70s where we were all locked away, that's what happens if we stop shouting loud and proud that we don't want that anymore. Right, that's where we'll end up again. That's the reality, right? The more they take from us, the less we're going to be able to push back. So it's really important for us to take those opportunities to learn from each other, to empower each other, and make sure that we never have to go back to living in closed off communities again, because that's not a life.
And just to put into context how close we are to that, recently, and I'm talking 2 weeks ago, so we're in February now, so about 2 weeks ago, Bristol Council, I'm pretty sure it was Bristol Council, had, they were going through the process of making it part and parcel of their disability services that you would be locked in your care service or your home if you weren't, it was along the lines of like, if you weren't able to be cared for, or you were not necessarily adhering to the care that they were going to give you, they would lock you in your house. And that was like a blanket thing. They would lock you away. And we're in 2024. And that was something that was going through their council.
Yep. I know exactly what you're talking about. And it's scary to think that they almost got away with it without anyone finding out about it, right? So I don't think they'll get away with it, if I'm honest, because now there's a lot of disability organisations involved and shouting about it. But the reality is that that is one judgment away, right? That can happen tomorrow anywhere in the UK, and it's going to be even harder to get those rights back again once that stuff like that gets through or gets passed. As this is how we're going to do it from now on. You know, just yesterday I was filling in a form sent to me by the House of Commons, because I signed a petition around the fact that there's not enough accessible homes in the UK. And in that form, I was saying, you know, we have government ministers coming out and saying it's our duty to go and work. But when we go and work, we're penalized because we earn too much. Because the systems they've put in place to support us only look at our income and not at our expenditure. How is that a justified legal approach to a means test if you're not looking at what's going out, but only at what's coming in? You know, I was telling another magazine publication, which I was interviewed by, which will hopefully be out soon, about my experience with the disabled facilities grant. So when I first started applying, my partner and I were earning 31,000-ish per year together, combined, right? The council said that with our combined income, we can afford to fund a £50,000 project, so therefore they're not going to help us. And when I challenged it, the assessor said, the system only looks at what you earn, it doesn't look at what you spend. Yeah, that was the answer that I got. So I was then put in a position where, do I continue taking the chance in leaving my home with two different ramps to try and go up and over a door threshold to get out of my home, and only showering once a week because my bathroom wasn't a wet room, or do I go to the bank and borrow a significant amount of money and pay it off over 5 years in order to live a more accessible life? And obviously I chose the latter because I wasn't going to risk it anymore. And this is what they don't realize, is that they keep pushing us to go out and work, but they then pull the rug out from underneath us with the support they're supposed to give us, that they committed to giving us, right? And I think there's a major financial problem across the UK with county councils going bankrupt. And I can see that those who need their support the most, not just disabled people, but those who truly are in the system because they need support, are going to suffer tremendously because managers don't know how to manage their budgets. And the systems in place to support us have not been designed in a way that benefit us. It's been designed in a way to save the council money.
Yeah. And everything you said is just, it's so true. And when we think about, there's 2% of MPs are disabled. And then, like, that's not a reflection of the UK. It's a lot more than 2% of the UK is disabled.
It's scary. It's scary. And, you know, just the other day there was the article around them wanting to get rid of the disability minister.
Yeah.
And that to be, that function to be controlled by, I think it was the social care minister. We already know that there's a problem with social care. And now you want them to be in control of us as well. It's crazy. It's crazy. I mean, even thinking about the access to work scheme, you know, having to wait 3, 4, 5 months for them to get to your case before even talking to you about why you're applying for access to work. What company is going to wait 5, 6, 7 months for you to get money to get the support that you need in order to do your job?
Yeah. No. It is wild, and it is a scary, scary state. But actually, with disability comes a lot of questions, and that's from forms, and that's from people, and that's sometimes from the general public. And I was wondering, is there a particular set of weird questions that you get surrounding your disability from the general public? Somehow, the way that you're like nodding your head makes me think, yes, yes, there is.
Somehow I knew you were going to ask this question. So I'm a little bit prepared. I think some of the weird question was, some of them are around, do you work?
Yeah.
Oh my God, really? That's amazing. And whilst I can see their perspective and them thinking, holy shit, look at him and he can work, it's just the way that they articulate it that makes you think, well, okay, I'm not a piece of meat, right? I'm sitting right here, you know?
Yeah.
And things like, can you be intimate with your partner? That's a question I get quite a lot. I think it's also why I want to start. I made a decision the beginning of this year that I wanted to start advocating more around those taboo subjects of disability. Mm-hmm. So sex and relationships and intimacy and the fact that it's not as hidden away or rare as people think. Because I think the problem is there's so many unknowns about disability still that people are forced to ask those kind of questions because they're curious.
Yeah. And I think what you just said is like a nail on the head moment, is that people are almost forced to ask these questions because they don't know where else to get the answers. And people are naturally curious, whether it's good or bad. Yep. Like, And particularly when we're thinking about the general public, sometimes, as much as I like to think I carry a lot of decorum, not everybody carries the same amount of decorum that I do. And people are also not as articulate, which is like absolutely not a character flaw. I really pride myself on my articulation, but some people don't have that ability and they just come out. It's almost like word vomit. And as soon as it's out, it's out. And it's whether or not and how you deal with those questions that I always find super interesting.
Yeah, so first thing, I just want to point out that I think I want to disagree. We'll have to agree to disagree on your decorum. I think that's a debate for another podcast. no, all jokes aside, I think that's spot on. I've always believed that no matter the question, if I believe that the question is coming from a place of curiosity, then I will always answer it because I would rather them know than make an assumption because... Yeah. I mean, we all know that common saying, assumption is the mother of all F-ups, right? So I would rather tell them so that they know before guessing. But I think there's a difference when you can sense that it's coming from a place of malice. You know, I remember when I was working in telesales, which is a really difficult job because people hate getting calls from salespeople on the phone, especially if you're trying to sell them life insurance. And I remember one guy, he said to me, are you this pathetic that you're doing this job? Are you that uneducated that you're doing this job? Like, you're a low-life piece of shit. And I was like, I'm doing this job because I'm in a wheelchair. It's the only job I could get. And there was just silence on the other side of the phone, right? So those kind of questions are said with malice and with intent to hurt, right? Mm-hmm. To cause harm. But for me, when I can sense that that's more out of curiosity, I would rather answer that question. I remember I used to chat online a lot. I when I was younger, I was addicted to it, and I would be online for like 17 hours a day. And on my top three questions, sex and intimacy was position one. People always wanted to know, like, is it possible? How do you do it? They actually want you to go into detail. Because they're so curious, right? So that taught me that, you know, there's a time and a place for those kind of questions. And there's also the mannerisms behind those questions that you need to be aware of. Because I'm all for advocating and I'm all for giving people knowledge. But if it's for the wrong reasons, I'll just tell them that's not a question you need to know the answer to.
Yeah. And I love that as well, because there is a time and place, and sometimes you don't need to answer them, and sometimes you don't need to ask them either. Like, that's also a thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think if you think about when we were children, we would be so curious about everything, and sometimes our parents or grandparents would be like, "Can you stop asking questions? It's enough, right?" And I think because we get that curiosity stifled, we tend to forget that we were once curious too.
Yeah, that's so true.
When we come to that realization that we were once curious and we should have remained curious, it then becomes easier to handle those situations. It doesn't feel so awkward because you're understanding that this is about someone wanting to know. And to be fair, some of those questions leaded up into actually meeting someone and having a relationship with them, you know? So you never know where a question like that can take you. You never know where a question about your disability can end up getting you a job or an opportunity for a job or a business partner, right? The possibilities are endless. It's just about handling those situations in the right way. That's all.
Yeah. I have one final question for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to say that I've loved this. This chat has been so informative. Between differences in country, differences in treatment, education, how we view disability, mindset. I've loved all of it. But my final question for you is, are you disabled and proud?
I mean, that's probably the easiest question you've asked me today. absolutely. I am proud of having SMA. I am proud that I am who I am. You know, I think going to do some public speaking, sometimes I get a question around, do I wish I ever walked?
Mm-hmm.
And my answer is no, because then that means I have to do my own chores. You know, it's a great icebreaker for a Q&A session. But the fact that I am disabled, I think, has given me the resilience I have today, and it's turned me into the person I've become today in terms of learning how to adapt to situations really quickly, staying calm and connected in times of serious crises, because that happens a lot when you're disabled, right? And being bold enough to say that I won't be what society wants me to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's so much to be said in like almost sticking your middle finger up to society and being like, actually, fuck you, I'm going to survive. I don't care what you say.
Yeah. Like when I tell people I want to go skydiving, they think I'm crazy. It's like, well, how many people like me can say they've been skydiving, right? I mean, it's about living life and pushing those boundaries, because if we don't push our boundaries, we'll never know what they are.
Mm-hmm. Exactly that. I have loved this, Louis. I've had the best time. I'm so thankful that you've come on the pod, because I've really enjoyed it. And yeah, I will speak to you so soon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Disabled and Proud. If you've enjoyed the show, then please give it some love by leaving us a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts. It really helps us to reach more and more people each week. Plus, if you've got a particular highlight, then I'd absolutely love to hear it. Tag me on your Insta stories @Disabled and Proud Podcast.